Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. Today, Alfred Addisk will be joining James Corbett of the Corbett Report as they join each other each day, or each Thursday, I should say. And I will be joined with after the market report with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. She's got some great information. We're going to be talking about RoboDocs. Sounds like a great interview with Wendy. But first, let's get to the market report for Thursday, May 14th, 2015. Gold prices hit a three-month high today. Of course, we had a great day yesterday, so we had some good follow-through with gold. It's off the highs of the day, but still, I would have liked to have seen it close above that 1224 level, but we're close. Gold is up $6.40 at $12.22. Silver's up 31 cents at $17.51. And the silver's futures remain at a three-month high today also. The U.S. dollar hit a nearly a four-month low in overnight trading. It did rebound. Let's go on with the platinum. Platinum was up $10 at $11.62. And palladium down $4 at $7.85. The USDX today down 0.26 at 93.42, and pressure on oil down 73, and that brings us back down below 60 at 59.77. And the paper markets today, they were up strong. They opened and they stayed strong, about 180 for most of the day. And it's topping out at 191 points. Up at 18,252. The NASDAQ, it's up 69 points, 5,050. The S&P up 22 at 2121. And 10-year yield 2.24, down just a little. But the euro, of course, with all that pressure that we've seen on the U.S. index, U.S. dollar, you have the euro trading at 1.14%. I guess there was some sort of a holiday in European markets, so not a lot of action there, fairly quiet in Europe, and the Asian markets also were fairly quiet, with the Shanghai doing the best. Let's see if there's any information here that I'd like to share with you before we bring on Wendy. The U.S. job market today, that did help lift the stock markets. today. Applications for unemployment aid fell last week. It's interesting. They say sending the four-week average down to its lowest level in 15 years. That means it's the lowest level since April of 2000. You know, it's hard to compare today's jobs, the unemployment, to April of 2000. And certainly it's a lot of people falling off and they don't get their benefits anymore. I don't think it's so much as a great job recovery. So again, you have to look to see why the, you know, why is it at the lowest level since April of 2000? We also have falling prices, the producer price index that tracks the prices of goods and services before they reach consumers. That fell 0.4% last month. And again, it's just another sign that the Federal Reserve could be holding off on raising key interest rates until later this floor or later this fall. As with that particular index, it would point to inflation not being a big issue, so therefore the Fed's going to wait. So I can't wait to see what they're going to come up with in September to keep the Fed from moving those interest rates higher. But, you know, they're between a rock and a hard place, folks. Not a good place to be, and it's not a good place to be if you don't have any gold and silver with them being between the rock and the hard place. So give us a call. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. You don't want to be caught between the rock and the hard place without your gold. Wendy Wilson should be here with Apothecary Herbs. Good afternoon, Wendy.
Good afternoon, Melody. How you doing?
I'm doing just great, just great. And you're going to talk a little bit about these RoboDocs.
Yeah, we've got this data science industry that's going to pretty much infiltrate the healthcare industry. Pros and cons to that, people for and against it. And people want, you know, the healthcare industry to be more efficient, more cost effective. You know, what business wouldn't want that for their bottom line? And the healthcare industry really isn't any different. So back in 1962, the auto industry started replacing human employees with robots. And since 1980, basically we've had a new robot enter the marketplace every month. So this is not new. So robots entering healthcare and influencing maybe life and death situations, well, that's an area that some people have a concern with. So healthcare is moving possibly in that direction to use more robot machines, and basically, they want to eventually replace 80% of what doctors, surgeons, anesthesiologists, and dentists, what they do. So we're going to take a look at robots, you know, and I got to ask the question, who said, let's take a robot off the assembly line and put him in the exam room or the OR? What brainiac said that, right?
Well, you know, when you think about robots doing surgeries, Well, I'm glad I'm not going to be around.
Well, you know, can a robot think on his feet or pads or whatever he's standing on? But Fortune magazine actually did a story on the future of healthcare and what it might look like. And they're convinced, though, that technology will improve healthcare and all the experiences patients have. It's going to make the jobs of physicians better. That's what they think. And they quote, they have this quote. They said, healthcare today is often really the practice of medicine rather than the science of medicine. So they want to see, you know, data science kind of take over medicine. Now, according to their report, the University of Miami did this study, Melanie, in 2005, where they withheld aspirin or ibuprofen from a group of patients when they developed a fever. So under the experiment, the group that did not get these types of drugs when a fever began had more successful recoveries and fewer deaths than the patients that were given the drugs. So the trial was actually stopped by the team leaders who felt that it was now unethical to allow patients to receive the standard treatment, you know, give them aspirin for a fever. So will program robots make such a call? Ask yourself that. Now, experts in favor of more automation really don't have a problem with robots making decisions because they're going to be outfitted with artificial intelligence, and that should cover any program issue. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, there's more and more of these folks that are coming out and saying, you know, this artificial intelligence, people should be, you know, very frightened of it, that it is the end of, you know, it's really the end. It's something they believe that in 100 years, these robots will be, you know, they will overtake.
They'll run the world. Yeah, our little carbon units, that's what they often refer to us in sci-fi. We're carbon units. We're nothing.
Yeah, we're nothing. But we already know that China is out there buying up all types of robots to place in their factories. And, you know, they have no problems replacing people. They have no problems with people dying because they can't eat and they starve. They're certainly not a humanitarian type country. So it's...
I know, but the thing is, you know, let's say you're in an accident, God forbid, and you got a trauma issue, and you're whisked to the hospital probably via a drone, and there you are in the emergency room, and instead of a human face leaning over you, it's a machine, right? So I don't know what's worse, a robot that's programmed to follow instructions, standard of care, or one that can arbitrarily decide to change procedure. Think about it.
Well,
yeah, she's speechless, I think.
I really am. I'm still back on taking the ride to the hospital on the drone.
Oh, hey, now, who do patients sue when a machine is taking care of them?
The manufacturer of the robot.
Well, the thing is they're saying, let's get machines because human error is part of the problem in practicing medicines. People are concerned with things like sleep deprivation of doctors, drug dependency of doctors, ethics, morals, all part of the human condition. And they're saying, well, none of that's going to influence RoboDoc over here. So, well, here's the basic concept I think people miss. You can't have something that's created without having a creator, and the creator influences the created. Right? So, do you remember that movie Starman with Jeff Bridges? It was a 1984 movie. He played an alien, okay? He came down to Earth, and he learned to drive a car by watching humans, okay? And he was driving actress Karen Allen in this one scene in the movie, and he ran a yellow light, and Karen called him out on it. But he replied, "No, I watched you very carefully. Green light, go. Red light, stop. Yellow light, go very, very fast." Okay? So they're going to be programmed to, you know, do what humans do, make mistakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So human error, they say, costs too many lives. Misdiagnosis is the primary argument. But machines are going to have their own obstacles. Think about this. Are they going to be able to deal with patients that lie to them? Or can't remember facts? Are they going to be able to pick up on those subtleties? Right?
Do doctors really do now? I mean, you're in and out of their offices so much, so you know, you kind of miss that. And I think too, someone mentioned to me the other day. They says, well, you know, you used to have a lot of compassion from the people. You know, if you went into the healthcare industry, you wanted to help people. Nurses became nurses because they wanted to help people. They wanted to be there. And now, because there's lack of jobs in other industries, you have people getting into this healthcare area just for the job. They don't want to help people. They just want to show up for a paycheck. So
yeah, you're right about that. But here's the thing we also want to focus on in this science data driven medical industry we're going to have. They're going to program the robots to overhaul treatment, and the machines are going to pick up on a whopping 80% of your current doctor obligations. So they're going to be doing diagnoses, tests, return office visits, writing prescriptions, and assessing patient behavior. So essentially, the robots will take over the initial contact with patients and formalize a treatment plan for them. So we're told this will cut down on errors and overhead, but that just describes basically what your general practitioner now does, right? So they're calling, experts are calling this rebalancing our healthcare, and they predict the robots will be bringing almost an immediate 50% improvement overall to the healthcare system. But if doctors are replaced by machines, so will RNs, other lab technicians, and so on. So what all this means is this data science technology contribution to medicine will take over triage, diagnosis, and decision-making parts of your treatment, which means we're going to need fewer doctors. And if we don't, and you know, a robot's not going to sit in class and cram for exams, so this is going to impact medical schools.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And here's the other thing. If we got it, if we got this, you know, developing intelligence, artificial intelligence, who is going to be eventually superior to us, carbon human units, doctors, humans won't be able to care for themselves anymore. They won't be able to become doctors. I don't know. I just see it could go very, very wrong. Let me read you this quote, if we got a minute. I want to read you this quote by Greg Fairhair. He's a medical consultant. He says this about this. He says, logic has the potential to make healthcare better, but only if resulting interpretations are applied by caring doctors and ones available in sufficient numbers to meet with and be part of the patient life. So if medical practices are reduced to algorithms, five-year survival rates, which would dictate treatment producing medical practice ceiling plans, he says the concept of fighting on, breaking the odds, faith, hope, and prayer would be vanquished from medicine, and the human race, he said, would be much poorer for it. End of quote.
Hmm.
Yeah. All right.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that disturbs me most in any area of business that I try to do is people are, they only relate, any service center or anything like that, they relate to the computer. If the computer doesn't say it, they don't know the answer. They don't think, they don't use judgment. Yep. And it is just there. They can't adjust and make decisions. And this is kind of where this robot seems to be coming in. It's mm-hmm. going to be that, and certainly no thought, no judgment, no. It will be a very bizarre world in which.
Well, it is,
folks,
but I'm just saying, okay, because a lot of successful medical treatments we had today came about through trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
And if data science is going to get rid of that, you know, I doubt robots are going to be capable of, you know, deciding on trying something just based on a hunch, you know? And sometimes that's when miracles happen.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are other areas that we do have computers. Of course, you understand autopilots and aircrafts, stock exchange algorithmic trading, mm-hmm. and now Google's self-driving car. You know, I just want to ask the people, what are you guys going to accept out there? What are you going to allow the future to be? Because choices today will determine what generations to come are going to be held to. See?
Unfortunately, those listening to the program, you know, agree with us, but yet all those young folks, all these kids,
they love
technology.
They're
growing up in this world or being conditioned to love it. And they can't see the big picture. They don't see the future. There's such a big disconnect from any older generation to these young kids anymore. So,
I personally like to take a break from technology from time to time. I like it.
Absolutely.
But I say to people, prescriptions can weaken the system, so look for foods and herbs that can strengthen the system. If they want to learn more, we can send them a free product catalog. And our number is toll-free at 866-229-3663, 866-229-3663. Or they can visit us on the website at thepowerherbs.com.
Thank you, Wendy. We'll be talking to you next Wednesday. You'll be back on next Wednesday. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Alfred and James Corbett will be joining you here in the next few minutes, right after these short breaks.
heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Are you concerned about prescription drug dependency to stay healthy? Are you worried that the cost and availability of your medications may put your health at risk? Perhaps it's time you consider a natural, safe, and effective way to deal with your health problems. If only you knew where to start. Start right here. Tune in to Herb Talk Live with herbalist Wendy Wilson every Tuesday and Thursday evening, 7 p.m. on AmericanVoiceRadio.com, where your healthcare options just became endless.
Hi, folks, I'm Alfred Addisk here on Financial Survival Programs brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James is, he lives in Japan, been there for 10 years or more, and if you're interested in an intellectual perspective on what's happening in the world, visit the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James, how are you doing?
Well, to be honest, I'm always a little bit nervous coming on with you, Alfred, because I never know what direction you're gonna take this week. So I'm always trying to bone up on and study every possible story you might bring up, and I always get it wrong. So
no,
I'm always excited to see what
you're
going to talk about.
I think you're prepared for all of this. I think you've probably... I'm not sure if you've had a computer grafted into your brain or an internet connection or something like that, but I know I am hard-pressed to find a subject to talk about where I can expect you to be completely lost and say, what the heck is he talking about? I've got one here from China Daily Mail. Let me just scroll up at the top. Take a look here. Yeah, China Daily Mail. And the headline is, China changes its strategy towards Japan. Unrelenting pressure has produced far greater costs than benefits for China. Does that sound like a accurate description of what's happening with China policy to Japan? And what do you think about China in general? They're building islands. Or in the South China Sea, if I understand correctly, that they intend to 1,000 miles offshore. I don't know if it's that far, but certainly several hundred miles offshore. They're building islands in the ocean that they will claim for themselves. What's happening with China right now?
You are correct about that. What was the quote from that?
Well, the headline is China changes its strategy toward Japan. Unrelenting pressure has produced far greater costs than benefits for China.
Hmm.
Are they easing up on Japan right now? Do you perceive that or hear it? And
I would say there's been certainly a bit of a detente. It's from 2012 or thereabouts, where we saw the real heating up over the island disputes in the East China Sea, the Senkaku Islands, as they're called in Japan.
Yep.
There was obviously a lot of pressure building up over that, and we saw some big protests, some anti-Japanese protests in China, some nationalist sentiments here in Japan. So we saw a lot of that being whipped up at the time, and I think that was perhaps related to Xi Jinping being relatively new in power at the time and trying to establish his authority and his control over the people. But the best way to do that is always to direct them at a boogeyman. And then on the other side, you had Abe was campaigning at that time, and his base is really that nationalist base in Japan. So I think they were both playing to political crowds, and I think that might have been part of the reason why it seemed to be fanning, the flames were being fanned at that time, and perhaps part of the reason why that's been backed off since then. I think there's still, of course, there's regular stories about Japan scrambling jets to deal with Chinese fighter jets that are straying into their space, and all that sort of thing still continues to happen, but it's not really the pressing issue that it was back a few years ago, and it's not being trumpeted and played out in the media quite as much. So I think there's been a backing off. And I place it more within that political context, although I'm sure there are probably other reasons for that as well.
Well, here's one of the reasons. The article says Japan's direct investment in China fell by 38.8% year on year in 2014 to $4.33 billion. So Japan had been investing in China, presumably trying to make ties that would make military conflict improbable and something people wouldn't want to get into. I'm guessing, but I would, you know, you think that's a reasonable guess?
Yes. Well, there may even just be straight economic reasons for not wanting to invest in China at this time. Obviously, there has been that slowdown in the export-heavy economy of China as it tries to struggle to perhaps make a transition to more of a domestic-based economy. So it is, I think, a less attractive investment than it has been over the past 15 years. So I think there may just be straight economic reasons for not wanting to put so much capital into China at this time, and that's exacerbated by those kind of political tensions that we know.
But they might be misinterpreted to be a result of the political tensions rather than the fact that Japan is short on cash.
Exactly right.
Yep. Yeah. All right, I got another one here from what's this? World Politics Journal. The European Central Bank's asset purchases program helps to end the Eurozone's four-month spell of deflation. I'm just interested in whether you think the ECB, the European Central Bank, have they paid in enough money, injected enough money into the European economy to end deflation? And do you see the economies of the globe tending more for deflation, or are we going back to inflation? What do you think is more likely?
Well, there is, as we've talked about before, there is definitely a deflationary undertow right now. And obviously what the past 5 years or so has been about is this attempt to inflate the bubble faster than it's deflating. And so we've seen unprecedented, literally world historically unprecedented amounts of money being created through all of these unconventional monetary tools by various central banks. And in fact, China looks like it's going to be the next to engage in this, as we say, its export-driven economy is being hurt right now by the fact that they haven't been able to devalue the yuan in the same way that Japan has devalued the yen, and the euro has been devalued, and the U.S. dollar has been attempted to be devalued. So now, apparently, China is going to start either engaging in some quantitative easing or engaging in basically a type of bond collateral deal with some of the banks that are that may or may not buy some municipal bonds that are being issued to basically try to alleviate some of the debt burden that China is getting into. All of which is very fascinating. The question, of course, is the ECB's actions and their QE program that's just kicked off. Is this really going to be what gets the Eurozone out of its deflationary cycle? I remain incredulous. I think that it may have that cosmetic effect, and it may have a real effect on the markets per se in the coming year or two. But I think it's going to be exactly a similar situation to the Federal Reserve's QE program, which of course is the one that is the example that they're all following, the playbook that they're all reading from. And in that example, we did have the Federal Reserve, of course, stepping in with its trillions and trillions that it created and used to buy bonds and mortgage-backed securities and other things. And that did have an effect of at least preventing the great deflationary cycle from all the deleveraging that was going on.
So far.
Exactly. But of course, now that they've at least taken their foot off the gas pedal, as we've talked about with the ending of the QE program, and are now actually apparently going to put it on the brake with the inflation rate adjustment that supposedly is going to come this year, I think we're going to see the ultimate failure of the QE program, because at the end of the day, all of these central bank tricks are really just ways of trying to get people convinced that the environment is safe enough to start spending and investing capital again. And I don't think any amount of European central bank trick is going to convince the European public of that when they see and they feel the reality of what's happened over the past several years on the ground each and every day. We still have ridiculous amounts of unemployment amongst the youth, especially there in the southern European so-called pigs countries. We still have the fiasco of Greece continuing to unfold. And the latest, of course, was that Greece was allowed to use some of their reserve holdings as a payment against their IMF.
They don't have any more.
Exactly. Well, they have to replace that back into their reserve holdings 1 month from now. So all they've done is kick that down the road another month. And this will continue to play out. My prediction would be that there will not be a Greek exit from the Eurozone anytime in the foreseeable future, not because of economic reasons. I mean, it should have happened. They never should have been allowed in the first place, even by the Eurozone's own rules. But I don't think it'll happen for economic reasons. I think it won't happen because of the geopolitical reasons. And Dr. Mark Faber of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom report put this very well recently in an interview where he was talking about how the fact that basically Europe and NATO specifically needs Greece as the bulwark against the so-called Russian threat, and they're not going to let them get out of the Eurozone sphere of influence at all. It's just not going to happen, and I tend to agree with that. I just don't think they're going to allow it. So they'll do whatever tricks and chicanery. But still, people, especially in Greece, obviously see through that. There's no fundamental confidence that's being restored in the markets. All that people are doing is seeing that, oh, they're going to paper over this problem. And I don't think that's the fundamental basis for the real kicking off of true economic growth again. So there are cosmetic effects. There are sort of effects that happen simply from the printing of the paper, but I don't think it's a lasting effect. And as soon as they stop with their, you know, funny money from heaven, it's going to be exactly like in the U.S. situation.
I mean, if I understand correctly, Greece has dipped into its an emergency fund to pay off $780 million or thereabouts just in the last day or so. And that essentially, according to some reports, has left them basically penniless. They may be able to collect more money as time goes on. They can collect more taxes. But it's interesting to me to compare $780 million, if I understand correctly, paid off in the last week, last few days, maybe just in late yesterday, I don't know. But versus the total size of the remaining size of the Greek debt is about $330 billion. Now, they're having all they can do to pay off $780 million. That's like a third of a percent, less than a third of a percent of their total debt. And it just tells us whatever, it tells me at least, that whatever is going to happen in Greece, there's just no way they're going to pay that debt. They may remain a part. They may never get to a Grexit. They may be. They may remain part of the European Union from now until, you know, hell freezes over. But they're not going to pay that debt, or at least that's the way it appears to me. Do you disagree?
I don't see a way of it mathematically occurring anytime in the foreseeable future. I don't see how they're even going to continue to meet their payments. I think it's going to have to be restructured. And I don't think that's going to be a dramatic default, because that would be the type of thing that would potentially kick off some sort of political crisis in the Eurozone that can't really be papered over in the same way. So I think they're going to have to reach some sort of agreement. But that agreement, however it comes and in whatever form, will undoubtedly just cement and further ensconce the bankster's chains around the neck of the Greek people. And again, of course, all of this is in service to the kleptocrats in the Greek government, who were busy plundering off the wealth of the country for a very long time and manipulating it into the Eurozone in the first place with the help of Goldman Sachs and all those manipulations and deceptions that took place. It has nothing to do with the Greek people themselves, but they're the ones who are left holding the bag, and they're the ones that are going to pay for this. And unless there's some sort of political revolution, nothing's going to happen.
Are they really going to pay for it? And what I mean by that is this. I'm reminded of Iceland. Smaller, it's a tiny little country. It's more like a one city rather than a whole country. But just the same, there's an interesting principle. They were caught in a similar bind. They owed too much money, and they just told the creditors, too bad. We're not paying. And they went through 2 years, difficult times. They were back on their feet after about 2 years of just refusing to pay the debt. And now they are one of the more prosperous economies that are associated with Europe. They're doing fine. I can't help wondering what would happen if Greece just said, that's it, we quit. We're not paying. We don't need any deal. We will suffer through 18, 24 months of this, and creditors will say, why don't we lend to Greece? They don't have any debt. Once they wipe out all of the debt they have right now, they become a pretty good candidate for borrowing. Now, it'd be high rates and whatever, but I'm wondering, would Greece do better to just say, to heck with it, we're done with this, we're not going to try paying it, sorry about that, but we don't have the money and we can't pay, so we won't pay, and let's all get on with our lives. Will Greece collapse into a decade-long depression, or do you think they could have a couple of bad years and get back on their feet?
Well, it is a different situation than Iceland, which, for all of the seeming similarities, was a different situation insofar as the creditors that they supposedly owed their onerous debt to there was no real enforcement mechanism in the same way that we have the direct ties of Greece into the Eurozone, into the IMF, to the people sitting at the table with them. So I think there's more of a direct sort of leverage that they have over Greece right now, simply because they're part of these institutions and they've been involved in this process. I think repudiation of the debt as an onerous debt, an odious debt, I should say, it should happen. I think that's the only real quote unquote solution to this problem. It's not even a happy solution in itself, because it will lead to pain for the Greek people. And it would lead to the Greek exit from the Eurozone, which would require, but it would undoubtedly lead to the creation of the recreation of the drachma. And that would be backed up by bonds issued by the Greek government. And there would be vulture funds that would come in to buy up those bonds.
They won't be doing them a favor. They will be, they'll pay a high rate of interest, but just the same, they'd be able to get loans after they wiped out the existing debt.
I think they would, but I think it would only be the sort of vultures that would be buying them. And yes, the rates they would be extracting would be exorbitant. It would be a lot of pain for the country. There's no doubt. I mean, there's no happy ending to this.
Well, that's going to happen one way or the other.
Exactly. That's exactly.
They're going
right.
to go through pain, and the only question is, how long is it going to last? How deep is the will of, what is the magnitude of the pain, and what is the duration? Those are the two questions, I suppose. Let's take a break for some commercials. I'm Alfred Addisk, here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned.
make the aspirin mistake. Aspirin was discovered by mistake during World War II and suppresses your immune system and prevents blood clotting. Don't expose your body to risk when you can use a natural inflammation and pain reliever called Extra Strength Pain Relief by Apothecary Herbs. Discover the power this formula has with salicin to enter the system in 60 seconds to work hard and relieve pain for 12 hours. Whether it's arthritis, sports injury, or flu, you can relieve aches, pain, and swelling with our Extra Strength Pain Relief formula. Call Apothecary Herbs now, toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adusk here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report on Financial Survival. And James said he was a little bit concerned sometimes about the questions I might ask. I've got one here that you may not want to answer. And I can understand that, and I don't object. If you'd rather just duck this question, that's fine. But here's an article from Newsmax, and it says, Americans living abroad set record for giving up citizenship. Now, you've lived in Japan for at least 10 years, if I understand correctly.
That is correct.
It's none of my business as to whether you have yourself expatriated or if you've considered it or you've rejected the idea. And if you don't want to talk about it, that's fine with me. I'm not really interested in this. I mean, it's maybe interesting if you want to respond to it. But I'm interested. You're sitting out there. You must know other American expatriates. What do you think about the idea of expatriation?
Well, I am perfectly happy to talk about it in my own case. I am officially a Canadian citizen. At least that's what it says on my passport. So there you go. And I haven't given up my Canadian citizenship because Japanese citizenship is not easy to come by.
No,
I were interested in it. So.
Yeah.
But yes, but there.
I thought you were a native of the United States. I thought you were a native U.S.
I am not. I am Canadian.
I'm sorry. That was my mistake then. All right.
A loyal subject of the Queen at the end of the day, or so she would like to believe. But. This is interesting because the American example is particularly egregious with the IRS claiming that it has the right to claim a portion of your income anywhere in the world earned, you know, no matter where you're resident, which is quite unique. There aren't a lot of countries that do that. And Canada and Japan have reciprocal tax arrangements so that you can't double pay. Basically, you're not double taxed. So the IRS is particularly unusual like that, and certainly I know a lot of Americans over here that have to deal with that, and some people have been quite frustrated by the fact that they're expected to pay tax twice, basically. So I certainly understand that, and it's interesting. I've been watching this for several years now, and it seems I think every single year since 2009 or 2010, I've seen a story come out say this is the year more Americans gave up their citizenship than any year previous, and it seems every single year that's happening. So there's a growing trend toward that, and I certainly understand it because, as I say, the IRS has its claws everywhere and is working and has been working for some time to construct behind the scenes a web that makes it impossible for anyone to really evade the clutches of the IRS, as people have done in the past. And even the coveted Swiss banking secrecy and all of that has been undermined in recent years by agreements that basically mean that the IRS even has its eyes and ears in Switzerland now, in the Swiss banks banking system. And this is all being formalized now in the OECD rules that the OECD is trying to put something together to make this kind of international web. Of course, the idea is to catch these corporate tax evaders like the Apples and Microsofts or whatever, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. But just happens to be, by the way, yes, we can also peer into your personal bank account and get all your personal banking details anywhere in the world. So I understand why more people are doing this than ever before, but it's still, I mean, a fairly drastic measure for a lot of people. And interestingly, some people have some problems with this process. People may or may not have heard of Roger Ver. I've had him on the Corbett Report before. Basically, he's a Bitcoin proponent, and he lives out in Japan and has for a number of years. I'm not sure how long, but he was originally American. He gave up his citizenship and his passport, I believe, last year, and replaced it with a St. Kitts passport, I believe.
Okay.
And so he was attempting to go travel to the United States for a Bitcoin conference, and he was denied a visa to enter the United States because the story is actually quite ridiculous, and they were claiming he didn't have proof of residence in the place that he has the passport or whatever, and they literally wouldn't physically accept his proof. He was trying to hand it to them, and they wouldn't accept it. It was a crazy story, but that's just one story among the thousands and thousands of people now that are in similar situations, giving up their U.S. citizenship to deal with the ridiculous taxation issues. And I think this is only going to increase from here on in.
You know, this, you raise an interesting point. I've listened to people talk about American citizens are taxed anywhere in the world. All right. And that is one of the primary motives that's causing them to relinquish their U.S. citizenship so they can live in Costa Rica, for example, and not be taxed by the government of the United States as well as the government of Costa Rica. That's all they're looking for. They're not just talking about dodging taxes or paying no taxes. They're saying, look, I don't want to pay taxes in two places. But that's the only way I've looked at this in the past. But what you're saying is that, and bringing to my attention, I hadn't thought about it before, it's not just about the individuals. It's about the corporations that are allegedly locating their headquarters, their finances, whatever, overseas. Multinational corporations, really, but if they are originally incorporated in the United States, are they also subject to being taxed by the United States government, even though they're located in Japan, for example?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think it just depends on how good your accountants and lawyers are. And obviously, the big corporations have the best in the world, so they know how to do that, how to play this game. I'm not going to get into the particularities of this because I certainly don't deal with this corporate tax accounting. But my understanding is, if you have these various branches in different countries, what of that is actually created or is income that's generated by the U.S.-based corporation, and what isn't depends on where you keep the money and how it's moved between the various branches and things of that sort, so that you can have, like some corporations that get a lot of publicity, obviously, in the States, you can have these massive corporations that basically don't pay any taxes on any of their foreign-earned revenue because it's all part of these foreign subsidiaries and what have you. And again, I think it's really just a question of having accountants and lawyers and that know how to play the game effectively and probably have greased the skids with the right payoffs to the right officials that go along the way. So that's why I think the OECD initiative is disingenuous, to say the least. I mean, I'm sure there will be some corporations that end up, you know, getting at least wrist slapped through all of this and having to pay more in taxes. But I think my understanding of this is that this goes more towards the individual, because I think that the ultimate point of this is the creation of the global chat tax framework, without which you couldn't even possibly imagine having anything resembling some sort of global governmental structure. You need to have the framework to be able to track everyone's finances everywhere in the world and to have this sharing of information between governments. That has to be the real groundwork, the cornerstone of anything that would resemble a global governmental entity. And can you imagine, I mean, from that cornerstone, you can build all sorts of things. I mean, imagine if they bring in some sort of, you know, the United Nations carbon tax or whatever. Again, that sort of thing cannot be built unless you have that cornerstone laid of having the sort of global tax framework. And so I think that's really what this OECD initiative is about. I think that's what the IRS is trying to do with its Foreign Bank Secrecy Act and all of these other legislation that's being passed to basically make everything as transparent as possible to the government.
When we talk about the New World Order and global government, you know, it's a subject that a lot of people talk about. But who points to the source of it? Where does the New World Order, where is it headquartered right this moment? And what is the foundation for it? Which nation or nations are really pushing for the New World Order? And where I'm going with this is the United States, the central force behind the New World Order?
That's a difficult question to answer, because what do you mean by United States?
I got an award for that one. I got an award for that one. I got a... all right, now that time I actually did stump you a little bit on that question. What I'm going for is the IRS... We think the IRS is trying to get taxes from Americans anyplace on the globe, right, just because the IRS is greedy for money.
Well, yeah.
But is it greedy for money, or is it they're trying to establish, build a foundation for what the New World Order will take over? Yes. And if the IRS is ultimately working for the New World Order, where is the headquarters? Who are the principals behind the New World Order?
That's kind of the wrong way to frame the question, because it's not aware. We've been trained to think that the New World Order, the head people, whatever, are in a certain place, in a certain country, and they operate from there in that country's interests or what have you. It isn't about that at the end of the day. It's about certain families. It's about certain bloodlines, even, I'm sure, at the very top of this, that ultimately I really don't think they care about anyone who isn't part of their little clique, whether they live in the same geographical area or not. So I don't think it is aware is this located, and I wouldn't say the United States is the headquarters of this New World Order. It's certainly been the driving engine for military enforcement of and the creation of this financial infrastructure that that will lay the groundwork for the next stage of global government. But I don't think, again, I mean, the ultimate end of this is global, so I don't think that we can locate it in a particular place. It involves the collusion, and I don't mean that in a sense that these people are all 100% on the same page, but generally speaking, the collusion of people in various structures and secret organizations and what have you in every country in the world. I mean, there are people who collaborate and collude in various forms everywhere, all over the world, and they're important in their different sections of the world, so that a Rong Yiren or whoever in China may be some of the most important people in the Chinese oligarchy, and they collaborate with the Kissingers and the Rockefellers in America, and they collaborate with the Rothschilds in Israel, and they collaborate with the various groups and the roundtables and what have you in England. And again, I don't think looking at trying to see the one place or the one group that is doing this is the right way of seeing it. I think it has to come about through the collusion of people in all of these different places.
Well, the question becomes, the United States seems to be working to implement, engineer, cause a new world order. They seem to be a servant. The government of the United States, from my perspective, seems to be serving that objective. But if the government of the United States is not itself a prime mover, then they're a subordinate and somebody's pulling their strings, and they are working for. They're not the source of the New World Order per se, but they are a very important subordinate, and they're taking orders from. And it implies that our government has been captured by forces of the New World Order. And is that an exaggeration? Is it a misstatement? Or is it just something like an idea whose time has come? Is that what we're dealing with the New World Order? Is it sinister? Someone's going to force this on us? Or are we, you know, finally going to see global government?
You know, that's a really good question, and one that I would hope that the alt media would be raising more frequently, because it gets to an important part of this this whole story, which is there such a thing as this wonderful, amazing, you know, benevolent government that used to exist, but it's been corrupted and taken over by the New World Order crowd?
It's always been corrupt and taken over.
Exactly. I mean, ultimately,
been taken over, or have they always been taken over?
Well, the way I would see it is that the New World Order ideology, the globalist ideology, the idea that we have to all, you know, unify under this global government, which is the ultimate end of this, is just an outgrowth, is just an extension of the seeds of the kernels of the idea that were contained in and of themselves in these national governments before them, and in previous forms of government before them. I think it is a growth of that idea. And so I don't think returning to, you know, the old, if there was some sort of, you know, pre NWO government, if we could just return back to that, everything would be fine again. I don't think that's right. I think we have to question the legitimacy of the system itself to actually get at the root of the problem. So it's not, to me, it's not the corruption of something that was once pristine. It's just the growth of an ideology that that is just reaching a more and more elaborate form.
Do you think the New World Order is essentially a done deal? Is it inevitable, or are there forces at work that are perhaps going to, you know, put a stick in their spokes and they're not going to pull it off?
If it was inevitable, I wouldn't be here talking to you. But it is certainly an uphill battle to fight against it. And it may just be a question that perhaps fighting against it can postpone it, and even that might be worth something. I don't know. But at the end of the day, I think there has to be a chance, honestly, a real chance to affect this. But the question becomes more pertinent, more to the point with every passing decade, because I think we get to that point where we are truly technologically reaching the sort of levels of control that wouldn't have been possible, imaginable, a half a century ago, say. I mean, we couldn't have imagined, really, the type of technological tyranny that could be implemented by a global government 50 years ago, as opposed to what could be implemented today. And I think that gives a certain urgency to this problem. And especially when we start talking about technologies like the transhumanist technologies and things that will start to be the brain chips and what have you, that again sounded like science fiction fantasy half a century ago, but are becoming more and more an imminent reality at this point. I think those types of technologies truly will decide this match. I mean, if you want to look at it as sort of the people versus the small clique who have been in power, who have always been in power. There's always been a small clique over top of most people, but there's always been this sort of suggestion, well, we could fight them off, we could slough them off here and there.
Not only that, there was the suggestion that it wasn't going to happen until Flash Gordon arrived and the Emperor Ming, and that would be in the next century or something like that. It's turned out it's happening in our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. We're out of time, James. I want to thank you again for being on the program. I always look forward to it. And folks, thank you for tuning in. James and I will be back next Thursday, barring the unforeseen. In the meantime, with the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank the producer, and James Corbin. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too fast. In my dreams.